The weather disasters in the South and Southeast have spurred many to reach out to help, including Iowans. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we'll hear about the scores of Iowa Red Cross volunteers at work in Texas and Florida. I talked to an Iowa couple who've just returned to their Florida home. We'll learn how the hurricanes have left many animal shelters in crisis mode. Also, whether bullying played a part in the death of a Cedar Falls teen. And comedian and author Sarah Benincasa on destigmatizing mental illness. Buckle up for your news buzz. First, this news from NPR.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a news buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. As of early today, the death toll from Hurricane Irma stood at 82. More than half the fatalities occurred in several hard-hit Caribbean islands, including Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands. In Florida, 1.5 million homes and businesses remained without power yesterday in the sweltering heat, 5 days after the historic storm ripped through the southeast United States. Residents who evacuated have been returning to their homes this week to survey the damage and to start the process of recovering from this massive storm. An Iowa couple is among them, Ron and Deanne Meir. I reached them last night, just hours after they'd returned to their home in Naples. Naples is a town of about 20,000 on the Gulf Coast in southwestern Florida. It was hard hit by Irma.
Hello.
Hi, Deanne. This is Ben in Iowa City.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Ben.
I've reached you there with your husband, Ron. Ron Meir?
Yes, Ron is here. He'll be over here in a second. We're just sitting on our lanai.
You'll have to tell me what a lanai is. Sorry. Oh.
Sometimes they call it a Florida room. It's enclosed outdoor space connected to the house.
Okay. So you...
It is no longer enclosed.
It is no longer enclosed. Okay.
No.
So you have spent the day getting back to your home in Naples. Let's remind our listeners, Naples is on the Gulf of Mexico. It's in southwest Florida on the coast there. It took a good deal of the brunt of this storm, and you have a home there. How long have you been back to your home now after the storm?
The house is mostly intact, but we had a giant mahogany tree that fell on the side. So we have this enormous tree that's going to have to be lifted by a crane to get off our house. We also have two really tall palm trees that are like the Tower of Pisa now. One is at a 45-degree angle, looming over our house and might fall on it. And another one is about a 12-15-degree angle, again, aiming at the house. So our biggest issue is trying to get these trees taken care of before they actually fall on the house.
Right, and I imagine there are a lot of people there with similar problems. Is there help? Is there a tree removal service available?
We'll see.
We called three services. All three, you get a voicemail. All three of the voicemail boxes are full. I texted them, and actually one has responded. So we've been sending, I've been sending them photos. And they're having an arborist look at them through the photos to make an estimate and figure out if they have to bring a crane or what they have to do and how imminent it is, because if it's not really serious, then we'll go to the bottom of the list.
Right. They're triaging at this point, it sounds like.
Yes. Our neighbor told us that FEMA did come in and clear the streets in our neighborhood right away, maybe even Monday or Tuesday. That we have a row of banyan trees that completely blocked off most of the neighborhood. So they were able to come in and they cleared all the streets in our area.
So describe a little bit of the neighborhood. What does it look like? What are some of the other damages you're seeing?
It's mostly trees that are down, palm fronds, those Norfolk pine, Those fronds are off the trees, some of them. Shrubs are toppled over. Some of them, they're just pulled up by their roots and just leaning completely over. Mm. Whether it's a palm tree or a hardwood tree, they're just laying on their sides.
It's pretty clear that our neighborhood had a lot of damage, and the neighbor has said there were small tornadoes that hit back in here to take these trees out.
So you arrived, you drove into town, you came from the north. What was it like on the interstate, on the highway, taking the hours to return to Naples after the storm?
Last night we were at the Georgia-Florida border, where we saw the first signs of the after effects of the hurricane. We went to a gas station that had no internet service and no power. It was running on a generator, and because it had no internet access, you couldn't use the ATM, you couldn't use your credit card, so you had to have cash. So a lot of folks driving down the interstate with huge gas cans strapped to the back or the top of their car. A lot of people trying to bring lots of fuel down here because there is no power. As we got closer to Naples, you could see trees taken out. You could see fallen limbs everywhere. Clearly, the worst damage as we came down 75 is down here by Naples, south of Fort Myers.
Mm-hmm. You both are from the Midwest, from Iowa. Have you ever seen anything like this in the Midwest?
No, not to this extent, no. And it's not like every tree has fallen down. It's strange how some of the palm trees look perfectly fine and are standing straight up with all their fronds. Others, their palm fronds are missing. And big hardwood trees are laying on their sides, pine trees on their sides, or snapped in two.
The storm hit here on Sunday, and the people who were here have been without power since then. As we got here this afternoon, we were trying to clean up. We had a broken window and trying to clean up some broken glass inside the house, and the power came on. We were very excited. It was on for about 15 minutes. The air conditioning was on. We thought, at last, some relief. Then the...
you could hear a pop.
The transformer went out, and now no electricity again. So we have no idea when we'll have power. And as you look at the people in the neighborhood, they just look exhausted, sweaty, tired, dirty, as they're cleaning up. So it's certainly taken its toll on everybody.
Mm-hmm. What do you both see in terms of support for the recovery there? What kind of authorities are out there?
We've seen in our subdivision, a tree service has been here. We've seen the power company out with their trucks. We've seen the landscape company coming, trying to get debris out of the road so that you could drive around and starting the cleanup. So there are people being, lots of busy people trying to load things up. But because there's no internet and there's no power, it's hard to know exactly what the extent of the support is and where it is. We just know what we can see out of our front door.
Mm-hmm. Well,
coming down, we did see trucks that said disaster relief on them. And some street lights, the big intersections, have power, but others don't. And there are police officers manning those to allow traffic to move smoothly.
Okay, you've just made me suddenly aware that the power is a precious commodity there, and I'm using your battery power on your phone. So let me just wrap up by saying, asking you, what do you see as the biggest challenges in the coming days for you and the community there in Naples on a whole?
Well, I think Naples, most of Naples, the city, will actually end up being okay because the people who have homes here, these tend to be vacation homes. They are folks who have some means, and they're likely to have insurance. We have insurance. So it's a pain to deal with this, but we know we've got some resources. But the folks who live in the communities outside of Naples, where they are the service workers, they are the folks who
store fruit,
do all of that, and they live in less substantial housing, but they had more damage. And you see pictures of that. Those are the folks who are really going to have a hard time because they're not likely to have insurance or enough assets to try to get themselves back on their feet. So that's what's going to be the most interesting, is to see what happens in these surrounding communities.
Okay. Ron and Deanne, we'll leave it there and wish you all the best getting things repaired and back in order.
Okie doke. Hey, thanks a lot.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. A lot of this first half hour looking at Iowa's efforts to help out in the devastated areas. Texas, we had first. Louisiana as well, the first storm. Harvey. Now Irma, the aftermath of Irma in Florida. This week, more than 70 people attended volunteer information sessions at the American Red Cross serving Greater Iowa. Regional Communications Officer Mark Tauschek says in a normal week, only a few people reach out to the organization about volunteering.
That is quite a surplus of people for us, and we're really happy that people are recognizing our need right now.
Currently, 50 Iowa volunteers are in Texas. Another 5 are in Florida, but Tauschek says more volunteers will be needed. Joining us now to talk about Red Cross's efforts in the aftermath of the storms, Dan Cataldi, the Red Cross's Chief Development Officer based in Des Moines. He's been in the command center in Orlando since last week. Dan, can you hear me?
I absolutely can.
Hi, Dan. Tell us, you're in the command center. What's the atmosphere like? What is your command center like there?
Well, it's been a long week as we spent several days preparing for landfall, and that's just getting people in places to handle evacuees safely. And since landfall, we peaked at about 200,000 people in evacuation centers around Florida. Post-landfall, it's been an assessment of damage, getting people out of those evacuation centers, hopefully back to homes that aren't destroyed, and then working to convert evacuation centers into long-term shelters, figuring out where the communities need feeding so we can get meals out in hands, and starting to get items like cleanup supplies and things like that out into the community as well so people can start rebuilding.
Mm-hmm. Give us some examples, Dan, of where you've identified the most urgent need, a sense of the specific problems you are helping to tackle there.
Sure. So first of all, it's the entire state was hit by a hurricane. So the damage is truly statewide. So when we talk about damage, you know, areas of the highest damage, it just means more than other areas. But there isn't a part of the state that wasn't impacted. And that's one of the things that makes it so challenging is that there's need everywhere. As we've looked at kind of those areas that were the most hard hit, certainly the Florida Keys are where we see the worst damage. We're just today able to start getting in there with our Red Cross teams to set up some shelters and set up some distribution points because those were pretty much cut off after the storm. We also see a lot of damage in the southwest part of Florida, kind of Fort Myers, Naples, Marco Island area where this storm made landfall. And then kind of the other big area is flooding, which wasn't really expected with this storm in northeast Florida near Jacksonville, where they've had a lot of river flooding and flash flooding, which may cause problems for weeks to come.
So is there power on in some of the places in Florida? There are certainly in some, but certainly a lot of areas that still don't have power, right?
Right. We know at the peak, you know, more than half of Floridians did not have power, and that was obviously a major concern. And power's coming back on, but it's a long process. We know that people will be without power potentially for weeks, and that certainly does start to cause some problems. Part of the reason we still have people in shelters isn't because their homes are destroyed, but because they don't have power. And it's hot here. It's in the 90s and humid. So certainly that is one effort. One of the reasons our efforts are so needed, why we need to get food to people. They don't have the ability to cook it, and we want to be able to get them a warm meal as soon as we can. So power is one of the major issues we will see as that's being restored over the next few weeks.
Dan, what are the conversations like among you and the other Red Cross workers there? Have any of you ever seen anything like this?
I think that this is fairly widespread for most of us. Some of us have been around since, you know, Hurricane Katrina, Hurricane Sandy, those types of times. But I think the widespread damage is really one of the things that's most unique about this storm is that it wasn't just a targeted area. Hurricanes are always a big area, but this is just everywhere. So it's certainly a challenge, a different challenge for the Red Cross response, as well as all of our partners that are working to respond as well. Certainly one of the biggest endeavors we've ever undertaken, especially when you can, you know, combine that with our efforts currently still underway in Texas as we respond to Hurricane Harvey there.
Mm-hmm. Who are you partnering with?
We partner with our government partners a lot, state, local, so county, as well as federal. We make sure we're in sync with them, having a coordinated response. But we also work with a lot of other nonprofits, whether it's Catholic Charities, other faith-based organizations like that, or other organizations that are there to do very specific things like help clean up. Talked to an organization earlier today that works to get children's footwear for children that lose there. So they partner with us to come into our shelters and make sure the kids there all have shoes. Mm-hmm. In our shelters, we bring in partners that do child care. So we have that opportunity for parents to leave their kid in a safe environment so they can go back and, you know, go back to their home and do some cleanup, assess the damage, and not have to worry about where do I leave my children.
Mm-hmm. How long do you think the Red Cross's service will be needed in this instance responding to Irma?
Yeah, we will be working here for months and months and months. The long-term recovery process, which the Red Cross will be a part of, will be going on for years. There are still parts of this state that are recovering from Hurricane Matthew last year, and we expect certainly with this storm that we'll see those recovery efforts going long into next year at this time. We'll be actively doing this kind of feeding and sheltering probably for several weeks to make sure people have that time to get power restored, get repairs made to their house, and get back in there. So unfortunately, it's a lot longer than we would like because we hope to get everybody back in their home quickly. But we know it's a long haul here, so we'll be here for a while.
Mm-hmm. Dan, finally, what can you tell listeners who feel helpless up here in Iowa that want to help in Florida or Texas? What can you say?
Well, first I'll say thank you because we have seen an outpouring of volunteerism both in Iowa as we've had people coming to our information sessions and on the ground here in Florida where we've had a lot of local volunteers that have stepped up to help with tasks. So it's a big thank you to everyone. We've also seen incredible outpouring of financial support that allows us to do this. It's very expensive to mount operations like this. So certainly a big thank you. So for those that really want to, you know, feel helpless, the best thing I can say is, one, you can still give financially. The need will be here for a long time, and the money will be invested right back into the clients that need it so much. And secondly, now's the time to start thinking about next time. So if this is something you want to do to volunteer in these areas to help with disaster, whether it's deploying to a place like Texas or Florida, or if you want to help in our backyard in Iowa when somebody has a house fire and the Red Cross responds, contacting the Red Cross, your local chapter, taking the training now so that you're ready to do it when the need is there is certainly something that anyone can do and that we certainly appreciate.
Okay, Dan Cataldi, Red Cross's Chief Development Officer based in Des Moines. For the past 9 or 10 days, he's been in Orlando at their command center there. Dan, thank you for telling us what it's like down there and also in Orlando and across the state.
Well, thank you for giving us the time again and appreciate you continuing to share the stories of the people down here who are vastly impacted.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, away from the storm news and repercussions there, you may have heard this week about how Cedar Falls police are investigating the death of a teenage boy in that city. Cedar Falls police chief saying that a 17-year-old boy killed himself this week. They are investigating whether bullying played a factor in his death. Evidently, also working with the Blackhawk County attorney to see if there is a criminal case here. In our Cedar Falls studio, Alan Heisterkamp joins us, director of the Mentors in Violence Prevention Institute at the Center for Violence Prevention at UNI. Hi, Alan.
Good afternoon.
I'm afraid I botched your title there.
It's a mouthful.
Let's talk about this case. We have about 5 minutes. I want to get your thoughts on this case as an investigation into whether bullying played a part is ongoing. Tell us, what are your thoughts here? Because we have several messages now have been seen there in social media that prompted this investigation.
Well, sure. It certainly is an incident that is... you know, raises some immediate concerns and, strong concerns related to everything from parenting to school administration, also the peers, the classmates, those who, you know, are either directly or indirectly impacted by the recent events. But what's unique, or I think what's different about this case and others recently in the news across the country, is this notion of linking this particular death to being supported and prompted by social media, or having social media being used as an avenue to communicate various messaging. And I think it was communicated on the news that there
right.
was messages on you know, both being responsive and wanting to be helpful, and also those making the situation worse.
Right. And in the latter category, this is, I'm looking at a KWWL TV report here. Several messages appearing to show multiple people joking about the teen killing himself. One saying, quote, "Do us a favor, kill yourself. Nobody, bleep, loves you." Another one on this social media responding, "Please, you don't have anything to your name. You are a bleep loser." And so, the victim posted messages to his own public social media account weeks ago. He's been suggesting messages about suicide and depression here too. So this is a new dimension we have with social media coming into this.
It is, and with some most recent data, 2015, with regarding this topic, 1 in 10, 11% of youngsters in middle school and high school report being on the receiving end of this type of bullying and verbal abuse. Mm-hmm. And so it's grown. I mean, it's become a concern.
How do we prevent this? How do we curb online bullying?
Well, curbing online bullying is really an extension and a derivative of how we deal with face-to-face bullying, or, you know, bullying in the hallways or in other, you know, social settings. And so it really requires some instruction and teaching with regard to that media, and really the techniques and strategies that we use face-to-face and in peer groups can be translated to the online. Mm-hmm. It really matters. It boils down to really helping folks notice. So think about the youngsters who saw those posts early on initially, or even before that, back it up.
Even bystanders.
Even maybe days or months before, where there were maybe some warning signs that were being demonstrated that maybe were overlooked. So think about the curriculum and our instruction that we, support in our schools with our health curriculum and other sources of well-being. What we need to get better at, and I think there are some evidence to support this, that we are increasing the conversations and instruction around not just the warning signs, but more importantly, what do I do and or say, and knowing right. where my resources as a young person are, who can I go to?
Right, and stepping in and saying, when you witness a message like that could be hurtful or even, you know, really damage someone with already a problem with depression, just say, this is not right, stop this, and intervene, I guess you could say. We have just a few seconds left, but perhaps before we end, as we always like to do when this sort of tragedy comes into our news, we want to, mention the national hotline. If someone, you or someone you know, has been talking about suicide, call that hotline, get them to call that hotline, 800-273-8255, 800-273-8255. We have a few seconds left if you wanted to chip in anything else, Alan.
I would just say that our work moving forward is really helping youngsters feel a sense of responsibility for themselves and their peers, because we have to build cultures of respect.
Alan Heisterkamp of the University of Northern Iowa. Thanks for stepping into our studio, Alan.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a moment, a comedian and author, Sarah Benincasa. She'll talk about how she wants to destigmatize mental illness. And we meet more writers from around the world who are staying in Iowa right now on a residency. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Talking about mental health and mental illness more openly, for instance, in the way we talk about many physical ailments, is something we've become a lot better about as a society over the past few decades. But as anyone with a mental illness can tell you, there's still a lot of stigma out there. Next Tuesday evening, comedian, mental health advocate, and author Sarah Benincasa will share her experience with mental illness with panic attacks, and college life during a talk at Iowa State University. Her talk is free and open to the public. It's part of the Mental Health Expo. Sarah Benincasa joins us today from Los Angeles. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, I'm so glad to be here.
Tell us briefly about the mental illness that you've faced and that I assume you'll be bringing into this talk.
Well, I started experiencing panic attacks when I was a kid. I think sometimes we are under the impression that when children display certain certain behaviors, that they're just the quirks of childhood, and that can certainly be true. But there are plenty of kids who need good help, and I was able to access it through a social worker when I was 14 years old. But I've been having panic attacks since I was probably about 10. And I started having depression at around that time as well. And so it's really been, I guess, a struggle throughout my life. I mean, I manage it pretty well now, mostly because I'm fortunate enough to have access to good care. But I will be talking for sure about anxiety and depression and agoraphobia as well.
Agoraphobia being, remind us?
Agoraphobia, well, actually, you know, phobia, of course, is fear, and agora is marketplace. So technically, I think it means I'm afraid of the mall, which is not true, as evidenced by my closet. But it's a fear of basically being away from your home, being out of your safe space. So some people who are agoraphobic, agoraphobia is an anxiety disorder, will, at the most severe cases, restrict themselves to their home or even their bedroom, being afraid to leave. And that's where I was at when I was in college, actually, when I was about 21 years old.
In fact, you wrote a book about it not too long ago called Agoraphobia: Dispatches from My Bedroom. Right.
Yes, and you nailed the title because you are a professional.
Oh, is that often mispronounced?
Yes, because a lot of people, and I understand because, first of all, it's a crazy made-up word, but also a lot of people have never heard of agoraphobia. They've maybe seen a film where someone is a shut-in and is terrified of leaving, but they don't know the term for it. But yeah, that was my first book in 2012.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, so with this background, with your background, mental health background, what is the message you want to bring to your audience at Iowa State University?
Well, the message I bring when I speak at schools and really throughout my work, I think, whether it's I'm writing about this topic in some sort of Hollywood way or I'm doing it in a book, is that you're not alone and that asking for help is a good thing. And my hope is that I can reduce stigma around these issues just by speaking about it in a matter-of-fact way, not making a huge deal about it, but just speaking pretty plainly about what happened to me. I'm not a special flower. There are plenty of us who deal with this stuff. And hopefully people, especially young people, come away from it being willing to ask for help if they need it, or being more receptive or understanding if, say, a family member goes into recovery for substance abuse, or their roommate starts seeing the campus counselor. Maybe if previously they would have thought that was a sign of weakness, they could come to see it as a sign of strength.
Mm-hmm. How much of your humor in your writing, or I don't know, I saw at one point you were describe yourself as a recovering stand-up comedian, so I don't know how much of that you do.
Recovery.
How much you do of that anymore? But how much of your humor in your writing, in your stand-up, has to do with mental illness?
You know, in stand-up, so I started out in stand-up. I was a graduate student at Columbia University for teaching. I wanted to teach high school, and I completed the degree, but I never actually used it in the classroom. But teaching high school is pretty similar to doing stand-up. I think you have to entertain people who don't necessarily want to be there. And so stand-up, I didn't really talk about mental health stuff. And then after about 5 years in, I started to, and I developed a one-woman show called Agoraphobia, and that became the memoir. And I was more able to do that for theater audiences. But there are incredible stand-ups who really infuse that kind of talk. I'm thinking of Maria Bamford in particular, but there are so many others. Margaret Cho does it. Mark Maron does it. People talking about struggling with depression and different things like that. So it was part of it, but not a huge thing. Since I turned my attention to writing more, it's been big. The first TV pilot I wrote was an adaptation of Agoraphobia. It's infused in some way into a lot of the things that I write, even if the thrust of what I'm writing is a, you know, a novel about, my novel DC trip was about a wacky school trip and for students and their 20 something teachers, but there are still elements of it creeping in there. I think it's touched my life so much that inevitably a compassion for people with these issues will come through in my work. And so the talk that I'm going to give is, won't be a stand up set. You know, I haven't done that in a while. I act like twice a year, but I do storytelling. But it'll be funny. It's not going to be a depressing talk. I can say that much. I hope people come away feeling pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Is it always clear when you're writing about mental illness in a humorful way, where the line is between appropriate and inappropriate?
Yeah, in the comedy world, we talk a lot about punching up versus punching down. So if you're making fun of something or someone, they should be the bully. They or the force or the thing should be the bully or should be the thing that has more power in a way that you feel is inappropriate. Punching down is making fun of someone who is a victim, who has been hurt. And so for me, I don't mock people with mental health issues. I will make fun of myself, but those are specific quirks. I don't make fun of myself for having depression. You know, I'll make fun of myself for ridiculous, absurd things that I do. And I think joking for me, when there's humor about mental health stuff, a lot of times I'm almost talking about it as this annoying relative who comes to visit and won't leave. So I may be mocking or making fun of the annoying aspects of dealing with this stuff. But I never underestimate how precious and important it is to give value and honor people who are struggling with it and surviving with it, because it's a lot of what I do is talk about suicide prevention and awareness. And so, you know, it's a struggle sometimes for people, myself included at times, to get out of bed every day. So if they're going to come see me or read something I write, it's not going to be mocking them. It's going to be in the interest of making them feel less alone and hopefully helping them laugh.
And finally, Sarah, I would like your opinion on this. As you know, we all know, questioning the president's mental health has become a popular pastime among professionals, journalists, ordinary people. I wonder, what are your thoughts, considering your advocacy for mental health? Do you think that helps or hurts the cause of encouraging people to access mental health services when they need them?
Well, I think that calling anyone crazy and meaning it as a the blanket term crazy is a very complicated term, and it's one that I used earlier in jest, but I don't usually use it talking about mental health anymore, which sounds peculiar because it's a term that's often used particularly to deride women usually. Oh, she's acting so crazy. No, she just expressed an emotion and you don't want to deal with it. When it comes to talking about the president, I think it's an important discussion to have, because even though we can all become sort of armchair psychiatrists, I think that when you're looking at someone who has the nuclear codes, let's say, isn't just your cousin who's annoying you, but they have the actual ability to truly affect millions or even billions of people around the world as the quote-unquote leader of the free world, I do think we need to look at someone's stability. Now, I am not qualified to determine what a diagnosis would be, but if there are groups of qualified professionals who look at behavior and come up with a I don't know if diagnosis is the right word. If there's cause for alarm because they think someone is not behaving in a predictable way that's healthy, I think it's valuable to talk about it. However, you know, we're not, it shouldn't be done in such a way that denigrates people with mental health issues. And that's why I think it's damaging. And trust me, I've said crazy in a derogatory way in the past about different people. I've done it in a public setting. And I don't do it anymore because I don't think that that is helpful.
Sarah Benincasa, thank you for being with us. Sarah is a comedian and author. She'll headline the Mental Health Expo at Iowa State University next Tuesday, September 19th. Sarah, in Los Angeles, I wish you a wonderful rest of your day.
Thank you. I can't wait to visit Iowa for the first time.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. They are among us here in Iowa. Since the end of August, 35 riders from 34 countries have made a temporary home in Iowa City as part of a 12-week writer's residency put on by the University of Iowa's International Writing Program. Well, back in August, just days after they'd arrived, I attended a welcome party for them and chatted briefly with about a half dozen of the international writers. Let's hear from a couple of them to finish off our program today. The first is a writer from Argentina.
My name is Santiago Giralt. I am from Argentina. And I am a filmmaker in Argentina, and I wrote two novels as well. And as I am a very strong Gemini personality, I also act and do some playwriting as well. I came to Iowa to the International Writers Program with the idea to write a novel that is it's a family saga that starts with an immigrant in Spain in the 19th century coming to Argentina, and then it's the characters start evolving and it becomes like a diaspora, so it ends in Alaska. Mm-hmm. The story.
And you're going to actually write this, work on this while you're here during the residency?
Yes, I have. It's a project that it's been on my mind for 10 years, and I have a lot of notes, and I have the genealogical tree for the family, because it's like three generation. It starts in 1890, and it ends in the future. The novel is narrated from a character in the year 2075. So in a way, it's a story that spans three continents and 200 years, and it talks about how in the world we live in today, people and migration is not an exception, but almost a rule. Like, humankind has already kind of like turn the world around the world once or twice or three times through generations.
How will being here in Iowa in the United States shape your work? Because we have very interesting times in 2017. You're well aware of that.
I have to say that we have a close feeling with American culture, because we watch a lot of movies, and I also read a lot of American writers. And also, I love the language. I love English. When I was a kid, I fell in love with the preciseness of the English language. Spanish language is very baroque, and it has a lot of flourishing. And English is very kind of straightforward, and it's very interesting for a Latino personality to understand the idiosyncrasy of a culture through the language. It's surprising, the political scenario of the USA in 2017. It feels a weird privilege to be able to witness how it is to live under such an unexpected presidency. So I'm looking forward to see it firsthand.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Iowa particular. Have you been to Iowa before?
It's really interesting, because my father is a grower. He works in agriculture, and his only big trip that he did when he was young was to Iowa, because the company that he used to work for, that was called DeKalb, that then was bought by Monsanto, used to have the main headquarters here in Iowa. So I have all the stories that he told me about Iowa when I was a kid, when he came back. So in a way, I remember the stories that he told us. And also, one of my favorite movies ever, that is The Bridges of Madison County, happened here in Iowa. So I always had a dream to be around the places where Francesca found her love and lost her love in that movie. So Iowa, for me, has the myth of my father narration and the film that I love a lot.
You, over the next 12 weeks, you will be with writers from over 30 countries. What is appealing to you as a writer, as an artist, about being with so many different cultures?
It's beautiful, because I really believe that humans are more alike than different. I really feel that if we scratch the surface, our feelings and our frustrations are usually the same, but we like to use culture to to create a division that I don't feel it's real. I feel it's it comes from the fear of the otherness, of the fear from something that is different. So in a way, living with writers who come from such a diverse diverse group of countries gives me the confirmation that there's still hope for human beings to find a way to connect, even when the culture seems so different and so apart. Because when you really start talking with people, and it's starting today, the second day we start like getting more serious in conversations, you start realizing that everyone had to deal with a father, with a mother, with a brother, with sickness, with life, with having money, not having money. Like, well, it doesn't sound very different from every experience has a common ground, that is the search for happiness, for even survival that humans have as a basic instinct. And in a way, I just feel very grateful to be a part of this.
Okay. Thank you very much for this conversation we've been having as a rainstorm, and some thunder is going on in the background. But nevertheless, I wish you fair weather, figuratively, and a very pleasant stay here in Iowa during your residency. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And storms can be very good for the imagination. So I hope a few storms to come on the way. Thank you.
We're getting to know a few of the 35 writers from 34 countries who've come to Iowa for a fall residency at the University of Iowa's International Writing Program. The next writer we meet is from Burma.
My name is Maunde. I'm from Burma, the country which was under the military dictatorship for 50 years. But now we are also going through democratization under the leadership of Aung San Suu Kyi.
And you said Burma, not Myanmar. Why?
For me, it doesn't really matter. Because Burma came from the colonial context, and Myanmar was named by the general. So, you know,
Burma and Myanmar both are the same for you.
Yeah, for me the same. Yeah.
Okay. Tell us, what do you like to write about? Where are you focused on in your writing?
I write poetry, and I also translate poetry and fiction, and I also do visual art. I mean, whenever I write, I think the kind of poetry that I write, it's experimental and associative and contemporary, I would say, because it also challenges the notion of linear reality. And also, I have a lot of political and social references in my poetry. You know, keeping it critical and playful at the same time. And also, I like to have some humor in my poetry.
Do you write in Burmese or in English?
I write in both languages. I'm trying to be writing in English as well.
Mm-hmm. I'm putting you on the spot. Do you have a few lines that you can give us of your poetry? Wow, we're in a thunderstorm. In Burma, do you have thunderstorms like this?
We have thunderstorms like this. We get a lot of rains during the rainy season because where I live, Rangoon, it's quite close to the delta. So we get a lot of rain as well. Okay, here we go. If you are lucky one day, you will see the coconut trees growing in your head. You will see Buddha, whose temple is your body, and you will have powers to drive away the black flies nesting inside your ears. If you are lucky one day, you will come back home, you will live in a sunflower, and the lampposts and the tongues will come out of the lampposts and say, "Welcome home."
Oh, that's a beautiful poem. And how interesting that these are not sound effects. Actually, we're having this conversation during a thunderstorm here in Iowa. How long have you been in Iowa, in the United States? Have you been here before?
I have never been here before, but I always wanted to come here because, you know, I've been exposed to, I think, a section of American society, American psyche through films and music. You know, I watch a lot of films, say like Robert Altman, you know, films on American political themes, and I mean many others as well, also the music. But now this is the first time here, and I'm very so glad to be here. And I have a project in mind to take loads of photographs of places, you know, that might have some kind of political and social character. And then I want to also write poetry to accompany those photographs.
You come here at a very interesting time, at least according to the other writers I've been talking to as well. And I think you would say most Americans would agree that this is an interesting time in terms of politics. And, and politics is a theme that you've taken up. Well, what do you find interesting about coming to the United States at this particular time?
Yeah, I feel that, I mean, America is not just one thing. It's many things to me. It's, you know, culturally very diverse, you know, and a lot of possibilities for a lot of different kinds of people from what I know, and also very politically divisive this time, I think. So it's really interesting. I only wish the best for the Americans.
Thank you very much for this conversation. We wish you all the best in the 12-week residency. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Iowa City.
Since its founding in 1967, over 1,400 writers from more than 150 countries have come to Iowa to enjoy a residency at the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.